Hey, Penknife listeners, if you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and, of course, tell your friends about it. Thank you.
If you'd heard of or read Hans Fallada before starting this podcast, chances are the book of his that you were familiar with is his final work, Alone in Berlin, or the US translation, Every Man Dies Alone.
Sorry, Ramona, I gotta side with the Yanks on this one. Every Man Dies Alone is a better title and a lot more true to the original.
No offense taken. Regardless of the title, the words inside are the same, and in 2009 the US press Melville House published them for the first time in English. The book received nearly unanimous worldwide acclaim. A UK edition and a movie starring Emma Thompson and Brendan Gleeson soon followed. Hans Fallada, who'd basically been obscure to the English-speaking reading public since the fleeting success of Little Man What Now back in 1933, was now in department stores and airport bookstores around the world.
And don't forget about used bookshops around the world as well. Every Man Dies Alone is everywhere, because it never sells.
It's true. It doesn't sell well, and that's a shame, because it should. It's still not my favorite of Fallada's novels. I promise we'll get to that one soon, but I have no problem with it being called his masterpiece. It's the fictionalized story of a real working-class couple from Berlin, Otto and Elise Hampel, who, after the death of Elise's brother during the war, decide that they need to stand up and protest the Nazis. They choose to do so by leaving postcards and letters containing anti-Nazi propaganda in public spaces throughout the city.
They leave their handwritten notes, which often contain misspellings and bad grammar, in building stairwells and mailboxes with the hope that people will read them, pass them around, and come to the same belief that the Hampels have, that the Nazi regime is evil and must be resisted. They call on the anonymous readers to refuse military service, stop donating money, and to overthrow Hitler.
And how did they expect their readers to overthrow Adolf? Did they want them to also start leaving anonymous anti-Nazi postcards in stairwells? Or did they envision a Berlin awash in Nazis go to hell postcards?
Well, probably not literally, but figuratively, yes. I think they hoped it would inspire others to also commit small acts of resistance, and that collectively those small acts could build into a force capable of actual change.
But it doesn't. In fact, the vast majority of the nearly 300 postcards and 8 of the 9 letters they spread throughout Berlin in the period between 1940 and 1942 are turned over to the Gestapo. After a short trial, they are convicted of treason and guillotined.
Damn. And did they learn that almost all their work got turned in before they died?
They did.
It makes you wonder, were people turning in the postcards because they were Nazis who wanted their authors dead, or were they just scared of the consequences of being caught having not turned them over?
I imagine it was a bit of both, but it also raises an interesting question. Was there so little resistance to the Nazis within Germany because dissidents faced such harsh consequences, or because so many people really loved Hitler and supported the Nazis?
Yeah. There are surprisingly few examples of civil resistance from within during the years the Hampels were dropping their notes, 1940 through 1942. I mean, there are countless examples of extraordinary bravery by Jews and other Nazi victims fighting for their lives, as well as lots of stories of Germans who risked and sometimes lost their lives trying to hide their Jewish friends. But in terms of straight-up political resistance, there wasn't much. The most notable example during that period is the White Rose, which is an underground resistance group of intellectuals and university students based out of Munich who covertly published and distributed anti-Nazi propaganda that had more reach and traction than the Hampels, but sadly resulted in the same fate for most of its members.
Resistance at that point pretty much equaled death.
Fallada's novel, which is of course fiction, sticks pretty close to the facts of the case, switching minor details like turning the dead brother who inspired their ire into a dead son.
And there's also the bit at the end that was left out of Fallada's novel because he never saw that part of the file, and left out of the Hollywood movie because, well, it didn't make for a Hollywood ending.
Oh, do tell.
In the book, the old couple die loving and supporting each other in an honorable, even heroic protest against the ultimate evil. But in real life, they each tried to pin all the blame on the other to save their own skin or protect their own neck. Ow, the best protect your neck when they found out they were going to be beheaded.
Oh, wow. That makes the story a lot less romantic. And less Falladian, I guess. He also preferred a happy or at least bittersweet ending to his novels.
Well, he also liked to expose real human weakness. Had he known about them turning on each other in the end, I'm sure he would have included it in his novel.
I agree. But it's interesting. The book's subject matter in general was a bit of an odd choice for Fallada. It's arguably the first anti-fascist novel to be released in post-war Germany, And while Falada was definitely anti-fascist, he'd also spent his life doing his best to remain apolitical and pretend that the Third Reich, World War II, and the Holocaust weren't happening. While the Hempels decided to risk their lives in order to stand up for what they knew to be right, Falada bent over backwards, or allowed himself to be bent over backwards, in order not to be considered a dissident.
But the flip side to all this, and the reason why this subject matter was perfect for Falada, i.e. the reason he agreed to write it, is that in a way it justifies his own decision not to resist. Remember we mentioned in the last episode that while in a psychiatric jail in 1944, he penned a memoir which is essentially one long defense for staying and towing the line in order to survive.
Right, so the Hempels are his proof of the futility, foolishness, and one could even argue, selfishness of resistance.
You say selfish because while the Hempels had no children, Falada did, and those kids needed to eat.
Yeah, and if Daddy were to be executed for treason, they probably wouldn't have had the best life in Nazi Germany. In the prison memoir, Falada writes,
"We didn't do anything so preposterous as to hatch conspiracies or plot coups, which is what people in other countries always expected of us, utterly failing to recognize the seriousness of our situation. We were not intent on committing suicide when our death would be no use to anybody."
Fair enough, but he still could have left.
That brings up the big question we keep coming back to with Hans Falada. Even if we accept why he didn't leave, because he was a frightened alcoholic who couldn't get his shit together enough to do so, how do we view him for staying, for putting his son into the Hitler Youth, for writing pro-Nazi forewords to his books and changing the ending of one to straight-up Nazi propaganda, and all the other things he did in order to survive while living, writing, and publishing in Nazi Germany?
Well, today, in the final episode of Season 3 of Penknife, Little Man, What Now? The Life and Times of Hans Falada, we're going to get into that question. We're also going to look at the final, nightmarish years of his life. But for now, I want to celebrate futile resistance by saying that I'm Santiago Lemoine, a writer and bookseller from Buenos Aires who foolishly prides himself in always buying secondhand stuff rather than new.
And I'm Corey Eastwood, a writer and bookseller from New York, and while the writing bit is probably just plain old futility, I think the bookselling I do is probably my favorite act of futile everyday resistance.
Okay. And I'm Ramona Stout, and I don't vote, which wouldn't be futile if I convinced everybody else to stop propping up a broken system. But I just haven't got the time, what with all my gig economy work. Anyway, you're listening to Penknife, a podcast about writers who may or may not have written about crime, but who definitely committed it. On December 13th, 1944, Hans Falada is released from the Strelitz psychiatric prison after serving only 4 months for the attempted manslaughter of his ex-wife, Suze. Germany is being pelted with bombs, food is scarce, and there's devastation everywhere. But our Hans, again sober, is happy and counting himself lucky because while in prison, he's reconciled with Suze. She's agreed to take him back.
All right, so he can move back to the farm in Karwitz and be with his wife and kids while the Third Reich collapses. He can harvest the crops, milk the cows, write real novels again, and finally live happily ever after.
That's the plan. And you can imagine him in prison promising not only Suze, but himself, that this time he'll stick to it. This time he'll really change. This time it will be different.
And it's all going swimmingly for the first 2 weeks upon his return. The family celebrates Christmas together, and with news of the war's end approaching, there's real reason for hope in the Falada household.
But on December 28th, he convinces Suze that he needs to go to Feldberg to tell Ulla that he and Suze have gotten back together.
Remember, Ulla is the hot young alcoholic and morphine addict that he was in love with when he may or may not have shot a gun at his ex-wife Suze.
Right. And if you're going to dump somebody, everybody knows that the honorable way to do so is in person.
I don't know. I think sending a text is less dishonorable than people make it out to be.
Well, to Hans, it's absolutely shameful. No texting, no ghosting. He tells Suze he won't be able to live with himself if he goes that route. No, he's got to go see her in person. But fear not, Suze. I'm just going to tell the beautiful, wealthy young morphine addict that this old Hans is spoken for. And damn lucky to be.
And so he goes to Feldberg and, surprise, surprise, he doesn't come back. The next day, he and Ulla are engaged.
No. Really, Hans? I may have been guilty of some less than honorable behavior when it comes to matters of the heart. But that's really low.
Hard to get lower.
But could it really have gone any other way? Just as writing was a drug for Hans, so too were women. and in his life he met no one to whom he was more helplessly addicted than Ulla. It was akin to a junkie, freshly sober, saying, I'm just going to go have a coffee with my drug dealer to break the news that I won't be buying from him anymore.
We're picking on him with good reason, but you also have to remember what's going on in Germany at the time. Berlin is in a shambles, and word is that the Soviets are coming. They're coming, and they're not happy about the way the Nazis have treated their civilians. And because every German who stayed has had to pledge at least some modicum of support to Hitler, well, they're all somewhat culpable, and there's very good reason to fear reprisal and expect the worst.
Right. So because the fear is that the Russians are coming, and they're going to do exactly to our women and children what our Nazi soldiers did to theirs, instead of staying on my farm and protecting my wife and children, I'm going to do the honorable thing and go hole up with my 22-year-old junkie mistress.
Well, he doesn't just hole up with her. That February, he makes her an honest woman and marries her. And since the bombs are falling and the Russians are coming and it's the end of the world as we know it and Hans feels fine, he decides it's time to allow himself a wee taste of his blushing young bride's batch of morphine.
Well, what's the big deal? He's been off morphine and, okay, on everything else, but off morphine for 20 years now. Surely he can handle a little tasty taste?
Well, his biggest problem at the moment isn't morphine, but more news from the war. Apparently the retreating German troops in the Soviet Union are pursuing a scorched earth policy, i.e. destroying everything in sight. His fear of Russian revenge is so severe it lands him in the hospital with heart issues.
On April 28th, Feldberg falls to the Soviets, and a bunch of Falada and Ulla's Nazi neighbors kill themselves. Some even take the lives of their own children.
The next day, the troops arrive in Karwitz. Susa's able to hide their 11-year-old daughter, but she herself can't hide. So many of the women the Russian soldiers know and love have been raped, tortured, or worse by Nazis, and now they take their revenge on civilian German women like Susa.
Afterwards, she requires immediate medical attention, and though her wounds eventually heal, the assault, during which Hans is nowhere to be found, clearly traumatizes her.
As it would anyone.
Well, the war is over, and the Soviets decide it's time to celebrate. On May 8th, they gather everyone in the town of Feldberg for a Day of Victory rally.
Because Fallot is a nationally recognized figure who's been a Nazi prisoner several times and claims to have written an anti-fascist memoir while in jail, they invite him to make a victory speech to the crowd of losers.
After fortifying himself with a tumbler of strong Russian vodka, he gets on stage and sings the Soviets' praises, saying they've come as friends, and calling for three cheers for Uncle Joe Stalin.
Okay, well, I'm sure that goes down well. Most of these people are legitimate Nazis. And the town's just been ransacked and the women, including Suze, have been raped by the people who Falada is claiming have come as friends.
Yeah. His neighbors who, yes, were mostly full-blown Nazis and have already hated him for being a drunken scumbag who left his wife for a 22-year-old, don't take kindly to his speech. Nor to the fact that a week or so later, the Soviets appoint him to be the new mayor of Feldberg.
What? A guy who less than 6 months ago was in an insane asylum for threatening his wife's life and who now is back on booze and morphine is now the mayor?
Desperate times call for desperate measures.
How's that Symbionese Liberation Army slogan go?
What?
Death to the fascist insect that preys on the life of the people? Yeah, that's it. And that's Falada's plan upon becoming mayor. He's going to completely eradicate the fascist insect. And he can't wait to get started.
But it doesn't take long for him to realize that it's infected the majority of the townsfolk who, to a person, all claim to have only joined the party because they were pressured by the Gestapo or did so for necessary economic reasons. They're fundamentally antagonistic to this new government of occupiers that Falada is a part of. And the economic hardships and further food rationing they're facing only make them more committed Nazis. You can just hear the refrain, life was so much better when Hitler was in power.
As is visible in most of his work, particularly his prison memoir, Falada is a resentful guy who likes old grudges. But aside from the fleeting joy of being able to screw over some of his former enemies, the power he now has isn't good for much more than a big headache. He has to deal with many cases of theft and domestic disputes and people refusing to turn over arms and Nazi propaganda. Plus, he constantly needs to find more accommodation for the huge influx of refugees that are ending up in the region. There's never any end to the work, and while he does his best, he's sure he's the most hated man in Feldberg.
To make matters worse, Falada is also sure that the reason the Soviet commander is overworking him so much is to destroy him in order to, quote, get his hands on Falada's young wife.
If that were the commander's intentions, he at least succeeds in the first part. On August 14th, due to all the stress, lack of sleep, and morphine use, Falada has a breakdown and admits himself to the hospital. With the coast clear, the Soviet commander asks Ulla to leave Hans and become his mistress. She declines, and shortly thereafter, she tries to kill herself. The attempt is unsuccessful, but she ends up in the hospital alongside her husband.
I stop in front of a large house. I go upstairs, thinking to spruce myself up a little, but I have to come to eat straight away. I sit down at a long table. Opposite me is a general. He is wearing a white linen suit, but I know that he is a general. He is mentally ill, and he hates me. He has a small, very red head, and he watches me silently through bloodshot eyes. Food is served very quickly, and the plates are not changed between courses. There's poached white turbot, pike tails in water as big, shellfish with mustard butter. No meat. They show me the huge menu, and I note that today is a meatless day. Finally, a large, white, marbled ice cream bomber is served. I take a large portion and put it on my plate, which is already full to overflowing. The ice cream immediately collapses and melts, spilling out over the edge of the plate. The whole plate now overflows. I spread my legs to let the cascading food drip down onto the floor between them. I look around quickly. The bloodshot eyes of the mad general are firmly fixed on me. Everyone at the table is looking at me in earnest silence. Between my legs, the overflow from my plate is still trickling steadily onto the floor. I go to the window and open it. I look out onto the church square around the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church. The church is burnt out. The houses around it are in ruins. The streets are buried under deep piles of rubble. There's nobody to be seen. There's a war on. I am my own ghost.
That's a selection from a dream fragment in Fahlader's 1944 prison diary, which in a way prefigures his life and his writing in the year to come, namely the novel Nightmare in Berlin, or as it's called in German, just plain, The Nightmare. The book is a fictionalized chronicle of the period in 1945 when Hans and Ulla get out of the hospital and decide to leave Feldberg behind and move back to Berlin in search of a fresh start and more morphine.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You and your wife want to start over, get back on your feet, as they say. I can think of any better place to do that than 1945 Berlin, the land of opportunities.
The city's been reduced to rubble. It's cold, and the apartment they're hoping to return to is occupied and badly damaged. They fight to get access to part of the apartment, but the windows are broken and there's hardly any shelter from the icy wind. To make matters worse, at this point all Germans must register with the provisional government and population movement is restricted. Since Hans and Ulla, as well as their stand-ins in the novel, Dr. Dahl and his wife Alma, moved to Berlin without getting permission, they have no ration cards and therefore have to survive off the black market. This might not be so bad if not for the fact that they're also hopelessly addicted to morphine. The little money they have and are able to scrounge up mostly goes to alleviating their dope sickness. And as everyone else is also hungry and suffering, just about everyone they encounter reveals themselves to be an enemy.
Fahlader's foreword to this book, which was originally published posthumously in 1947, is one of the most remarkable I've ever read. He writes, "The author of this novel is far from satisfied with what he has written on the following pages, which is now laid before the reader." He explains that he'd hoped to report the apathy and misery of the German population in 1945, but also to find something uplifting about the end of the war. But he deems the book a failure because he finds absolutely no reason for optimism. Still, he decides to publish it because he calls it a, quote, medical report that may have some value as a document humain, a faithful and true account of how ordinary Germans suffered in 1945.
For good reason, there's plenty of media, both fiction and non, about the Nazis, the Holocaust, and World War II. Like I imagine most people do, I've gone through phases where I've read a lot of books and watched lots of films about these subjects. But until reading The Nightmare, I'd never encountered the perspective of post-war Berlin from a German who stayed. And believe me, it's one worth reading. It's almost ironic that he calls it a faithful and true account and a document humain, because it has a dreamlike feel. It reads like a post-apocalyptic dystopia.
What's worse than the conditions they're living in are the characters' mindsets, which Fahlader stresses are reflective of the collective apathy and despair. The book is filled with passages like these, which really sum it up. It wasn't blowing a gale outside today, and it wasn't raining either. But never had the street they lived in, with its burnt-out ruins and huge piles of rubble, seemed to him so dark and menacing. Which is just what his life looked like, The war had destroyed everything, and all that was left to him were ruins and the ugly, incinerated detritus of former memories.
The novel follows the typical Falada storyline, where we see the characters wriggling themselves out of tough situations only to encounter tougher ones. In this case, Dr. Dahl and Alma are dashing about bombed-out Berlin on the hunt for dope, while also trying not to freeze or starve to death. It's made more difficult by the fact that Alma has a highly infected leg, which is seeping pus and getting worse by the day.
Sounds like the setup for a video game. Dope Hunt, where you can choose your world. 1945 Berlin, 1985 Lower East Side, or Shanghai in the early 20th century.
As is always Falada's way, he and his character eventually take refuge in a hospital, as does Alma. The book ends with the Falada character recuperating and beginning to write again in a woman's STD clinic, which is primarily populated with prostitutes and only one man, Dr. Dahl, a.k.a. Hans Rudolf Ditson Falada.
Whoa. Wait one second. I want to get this straight. So this character is almost 100% his author, and that author, one lucky Hans Falada, was addicted to lots of things, one of which was sex with prostitutes. And then he writes that his character, again, who's essentially him, recovers from morphine addiction by getting placed into an all-female STD clinic? Talk about taking some authorial liberty. Sounds to me like he's really just taking the piss.
Yeah, while there's plenty in the nightmare that's exaggerated or made up, this part isn't. He really did spend time as the only male patient in an all-female STD clinic.
Okay. Well, that's either a blessing or a curse.
Anyhow, Nightmare in Berlin isn't Falada's best novel. It received middling to poor reviews when it came out in 1947, wasn't published in English until 2016 following the success of Alone in Berlin and the demand, albeit short-lived, for more Falada. It, like so many of his books, was written hastily at breakneck pace in between bouts of relapse and recovery, and structurally it adheres far too close to the events of his real life to make it a very good novel. But it happens to be my favorite of all of his books, both for this previously unseen and incredibly fascinating glimpse of post-war Berlin, and mostly for the optimism that he claims he failed to put in the book. It is there, actually. Lots of it. Not so much in the future of Germany or in any kind of restored faith in humanity, but in his belief in his own writing, in the therapeutic, redemptive possibility of writing.
He sets it up from the start. In the beginning of the book, his character recognizes that no one's going to help him out of the hell he's fallen into. Not the big three, not his fellow Germans, not God. He writes,
"If he died there in the wet mud, too bad for him. But only for him. Not a heart in the world would grow heavier on his account. If he really had a desire to work again and write things, then it was up to him, and him alone, to overcome his apathy, get up on his feet again, brush the dirt off, and get down to work."
It seems like a bit of a non sequitur, no? He's talking about despair and apathy towards life, and then instead of saying, "I gotta pull myself up and live again," he says, "I gotta pull myself up and write again."
I think at that point he doesn't see the difference between the two. In a life filled with so much chaos, so much failure and self-hatred, writing is the only thing he excels at. It's probably the last part of his identity that he still believes in.
Exactly. And he views writing as his only hope for recovery. Drug addiction and the trauma of war have emptied him of his humanity. And it's through putting pen to paper and depicting his truth there in the woman's STD clinic that he's able to reconnect with that humanity.
Right. But it's more than that. He doesn't just turn to writing to restore his humanity. He's literally dying. His health is faltering, and suicide, especially the question of how to do it painlessly, is preoccupying him again. Plus, if he doesn't produce, he and Ulla will have no money for dope, no money to live on. So I don't think it's hyperbole to say that he's literally writing for his life.
Yeah. My favorite parts of the book are towards the end, where he describes sitting at the writing desk in the clinic. He's struggling with his work, which we can assume is the book we're reading, and while he's miserable, you can feel him beginning to come more and more alive with every page. And sure, this swell of emotion that he's getting from the written word will, as it has done countless times before, probably overwhelm him and lead him back to another nervous breakdown and relapse, but for the time being, it's clear that the writing is a life force for him, and it's powerful to see it nurse him back to health.
After surviving the nightmare in Berlin, Falada ends 1945 on a very distressing note. His former typist, a woman with whom he had an affair, has just accused him of having been a Nazi supporter. He denies this, claiming that she's just a jilted ex-lover, but as proof, she offers a letter he wrote to her in 1943 in which he claimed that the Germans were going to win the war and said, quote, "We are the masters of the world."
This was a moment of reckoning in post-war Germany, maybe not completely dissimilar to today's. And in a way, the experience of being denounced as a Nazi back then could be compared to being Me Too'd today.
In the sense that it could completely ruin your career, yes. But mostly for Falada, it and the other accusations of collaboration that pile up in early 1946 ruin his sleep and his health. To cope with the stress, he once again turns to morphine.
Things go from bad to worse as Ulla becomes increasingly difficult to live with. Her addiction is probably even worse than his, and the money she had when he met her is a distant memory, now replaced by rising debt for which he's responsible.
Hans managed to stay away from the women in his clinic, but later, in order to support her addiction, Ulla apparently turns to prostitution and contracts gonorrhea herself. It's speculated that she gives it to Hans, which doesn't help his already faltering health. On top of that, in September, Ulla has a miscarriage, and shortly after that, Hans decides it's time to divorce her.
But Ulla loves him so much that she says she'll only agree to the divorce if Suze will take him back.
What? Please, please tell me Big Suze says no.
She does, thankfully, and Hans stays with Ulla. This means he's going to need plenty of money for her debts and their drugs, so he goes back to the writing desk and gets to work on the novel Every Man Dies Alone.
He works obsessively, 14 hours a day, and manages to complete the 550-page masterpiece in 24 days. But shortly after completing the book, he has another breakdown and checks himself into a hospital. On February 5th, 1947, his heart finally gives out, and Hans Falada dies at the age of 53.
So, I guess it was Falada's greatest book, Every Man Dies Alone, that killed him.
Well, yeah. That or all the booze, sleeping pills, morphine, 200 cigarettes a day, plus the stress of living in Germany through the two world wars.
Hans might have said that it was his bad luck that killed him.
It's true. He was terribly unlucky, but a lot of that bad luck he brought upon himself.
And his luck could have been a lot worse, as it was for the millions who were murdered by the Nazis. Even Falada acknowledged that. He often said he had Glück im Unglück, which means fortune in misfortune, but also happiness in unhappiness.
Yeah, there was clearly part of him, the addict part of him, that took some pleasure in all his suffering.
And the writer part of him that delighted in it because he knew it was all good material for his novels.
I think that's key. I mean, so much of the debate around Falada's legacy is about why he stayed, right? Thus far, we've heard the excuses he gave, that resistance was futile and that emigrating was selfish, plus the excuses we made for him, namely that he was just too much of a junkie screw-up to pull himself together to leave. But maybe a big reason he stayed wasn't so much that he loved Germany, but rather that he knew there was nowhere in the world more fucked up than his fatherland, and he wanted to be there to chronicle it.
I'd argue it wasn't just his desire to chronicle it, but first and foremost to experience it.
Even though he went to the country to hide away and avoid experiencing any of it?
Well, if he really wanted to avoid it, he would have left. As we learn, from a young age when he loved hearing stories about his dad's criminal cases, Falada was always interested in the underworld and stories of people living life out of bounds. His main addictions were booze, drugs, and women, but I think he was also addicted to excitement and drama. If we agree that most addicts use drugs to escape themselves, then drama basically does the same thing.
Because you don't have to be present with yourself when you're witnessing or dealing with some insane life or death situation?
Exactly.
It's an interesting chicken and egg scenario. Was he addicted to excitement because it fulfilled his escapist needs, or, as we've just heard, was it the writing that allowed him to escape, and in order to write, he needed the excitement? As he himself said, he could only really write what he knew.
I'm not sure it has to be an either-or. I think, like many writers, he embraced hard living because he got a rush out of it and it gave him something to write about, but also because, as a hopeless addict, he really had no choice. While I think it's correct to say he was addicted to excitement, it needs to be said that just as he constantly tried to get and stay clean, he also desperately wanted to live a quiet life of milking cows, sitting on a porch and bouncing his grandchildren on his lap.
Absolutely. And that's why the two memoirs he wrote during the Nazi years, which idealized farm life, can't just be written off as books he wrote only to make some money while appeasing the Nazis. They were bullshit, obviously, because even his farm life was chaos, but they were legitimately aspirational. He wanted that order and decency.
Well, he was German after all.
I was talking to my buddy Joseph Harms about this, and he stated what's probably obvious to most listeners, but somehow wasn't to me. Since he was a teenager, Hans Falada was trying to kill himself. He failed time and time again, and he often wrote that the only reason he was still alive was because he was too much of a coward to do it right. After that brush with death where the brown shirts nearly shot him for trying to escape, most people's survival instincts would have kicked in and told them to flee. But Hans's didn't. I wonder if subconsciously it's because he knew that there was no surviving what was happening in Germany, and that this would be his way out.
So instead of suicide by cop, suicide by Nazi?
In the end, though, he survived the Third Reich, and he spent those years conceding to edits made by Nazi censors, writing pro-Nazi forwards for a few of his books and adding a happy Nazi ending to his book Iron Gustav.
Yes, and in doing so, you can't really argue with the fact that he was at least somewhat complicit.
And when you put it that way, it's kind of hard to disagree with Thomas Mann when he said work like Falada's is worthless because he stayed.
Well, this just brings us to the same separating the art from the artist conversation we have every season, this one albeit amplified a bit because we're talking about Nazis. I don't agree with Mann at all. From what I've read and from listening to Corey rave about everything else, I think Falada's work is pretty brilliant, and I highly recommend you listeners go and check it out.
Yeah, and I'd take it a step further and say that yes, his books are great, but also that Hans wasn't such a bad guy or wasn't worse than anyone else. Or what I mean, I guess, is that none of his actions should result in us thinking of him as someone whose art we need to divorce from his personal life. He was weak. He was a coward. He shot his best friend. He was alternatively loving and horrible to his wives. He was a drunk and a junkie who acted at the will of his addictions. And when we think of Hans Falada, we should think of all of these things.
And in Falada's case, because the books are so autobiographical and such authentic and vivid portraits of the time they depict, I think you'd be missing out by not knowing something of his extraordinary life.
Well, now, after listening to this season, you listeners know. Falada was a little man who wrote with great compassion for the little man and woman. And while he himself stood against anti-Semitism, he was at least somewhat complicit in the Nazi regime.
In other words, he was complicated like everyone else, or maybe even more complicated than most everyone else.
Complicated like everyone else, but he wrote better books than most everyone else.
And we're lucky to be able to read them today. Manlife is created, written, and produced by Corey Eastwood, Ramona Stout, and me, Santiago Lemoine. Hans Falada is voiced by Finn Lobsin. The sound design, music, and all things audio are the work of Diego Sanchez of La Pianola Studio in Buenos Aires. The logo and all things visual have been made by Nelly Cuellar Torres. Flor Lopez built our website, penknifepodcast.com, where you can find a full bibliography of the works we used in researching this episode. And again, thanks to Elurbster for letting us turn his spare bedroom into a recording studio. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and tell your friends about the show. We're not going to lie to you. We've made these three seasons ourselves with very little financial support, and it's been a struggle. We really want to continue to make Penknife, but in order to do so, we need your likes and reviews. Even if you think it's shit and you just want to chime in to tell us to stop wasting our time and money making this podcast, we'd love to hear it.
There we go.